Vietnam on permanent one-year orders, under which Tan Son Nhut became my duty station, rather than on 90-day temporary orders, which had loaned officers to the base while administratively they were still attached to a home in the States. The Air Force designated me a combat intelligence officer and immediately assigned me to a mid-shift watch, 10 p.m. to 8 a.m., in the Indications and Warning Center. For the next 4 months, a sergeant and I spent those 10 hours, 6 days a week, with Sunday off, reading reports coming in from the field and culling them into a black book of intelligence that was carried around to each of the Air Force generals in the headquarters facility. A very distant forerunner to the president's daily brief, which I would oversee 44 years later. In those days, intelligence was largely historical, telling people what had happened, not what was happening, and certainly not forecasting what was going to happen. It wasn't part of the find, fix, finish operations cycle, which didn't then exist, and intelligence automation was pretty much acetate, grease pencil, and two corporals. My work was a tedious manual process, particularly since I only had academic knowledge about signals intelligence operations and knew almost nothing about air combat. I lamented aloud that I barely knew the difference between flak, anti-aircraft fire, and a frag, a fragmentary operations order, or between an F-4 and an F-105. I imagined super-genius men with rows of ribbons and gleaming stars poring over my reports to decide where to attack and where to hold ground, making decisions with potential life-or-death consequences. Without any feedback, I pressed ahead, tired and stressed, marking off the days on my calendar until I could rotate home. The coup de grace for my morale was a letter I received from Sue just a few weeks into my tour, telling me that she was pregnant. I was despondent at the prospect of missing the birth of our first child. Then Sue's due date in June came and went, with no word from her. She had sent a telegram, but I never received it, and I hadn't been able to reach her. Jennifer was 2 weeks old when an Air Force general commented to Sue that I must be excited and happy to know about the expansion of my family. "Well, if he is," she replied, "I sure haven't heard it from him." The general promptly sent an official message to let me know that I was a father and that everyone was okay. The only relief for me that year was that, coincidentally, my dad was at Tan Son Nhut as the deputy chief of NSA Vietnam when I arrived, and our tours coincided for 7 months. He was working for Colonel Hank Applington, the same Marine who'd helped me into the platoon leader's course in 1961. Dad was staying in colonel's quarters, which were way better than what I'd been able to afford in downtown Saigon, and were much quieter during the daytime when I finally got to sleep. So I moved in with him. We made it a Sunday tradition on our mutual day off to treat ourselves to dinner on the top-floor restaurant of the French colonial-era Caravelle Hotel. We ate lobster tails with butter and drank martinis while watching as A-1s bombed and strafed the Viet Cong across the Saigon River. Combined with the haze I felt from working nights, sleeping days, and being completely disconnected from home, the whole experience felt surreal. In 1966, after 4 months on the mid-watch, I was moved to day shift work as an air defense analyst and assigned a daunting collateral duty. Every Saturday, another lieutenant and I would drive to downtown Saigon to personally brief General William Westmoreland, the senior theater commander for all U.S. forces in Vietnam. I had never met a four-star general before, much less talked to one. But I very quickly found myself with Westmoreland's undivided attention. After the other lieutenant briefed the entire staff on the numbers, bombs dropped, explosions, secondary explosions, bridges destroyed, roads cut, and the number of enemy killed, the general and I would step into his personal office so that I could give him the highly classified SIGINT Reflections of Airstrikes report. If we dropped a bomb and then intercepted a radio transmission of the North Vietnamese talking about being hit, the general wanted to know what they said. Before I left for Saigon each Saturday, we overlaid an acetate-covered map with little thought bubbles containing a succinct headline for each intercepted message. During the briefing, I would expand upon them from the longer signals intelligence reports. At our first few sessions, I was too nervous to notice the general's response to my report, but I was determined to read his reactions to figure out how to brief him more effectively. Paying closer attention during our third or fourth meeting, I slowly realized that he was just nodding along without really following what I was saying, and that the general in charge of all U.S. operations in Vietnam wasn't, in fact, a super genius with a grand strategic war plan well in hand. And my efforts didn't seem to make much difference to the fate of the soldiers and Marines fighting and dying in the jungle. That realization was probably the darkest moment of my career, and the first time I truly struggled with the question, why do we even do intelligence work? After a year at Tan Son Nhut, the Air Force assigned me back to Kelly Air Force Base to another processing branch, again as deputy branch chief, the same kind of job I'd had before going to Vietnam. Sue and I began to think the Air Force just wasn't going to work out and planned for me to finish my master's degree and then join NSA as a civilian. Then one day I got a call from a friend and classmate from Goodfellow, Jack Kohansky. Jack was one of the few officers who'd wanted a stateside job after Goodfellow, and when he'd been told he was going to a SIGINT station in Pakistan, we'd tried to swap assignments. The Air Force didn't approve of us questioning its wisdom, and so Jack had gone overseas. 2 years later, in the spring of 1967, Jack was working at Kelly as the aide to the Air Force Security Service commander, Major General Louis Koira. He had phoned to tell me that he had been accepted for pilot training and to ask if I wanted to interview for his aide job. I agreed and then asked, "What does an aide do?" That call changed my life. General Koira had been a bomber pilot during World War II and brought a self-effacing humility to command. He grasped both the details of our work and the big picture of its significance. Precisely what I'd found wanting in General Westmoreland. For the next 3 years, General Koira and I traveled the world, spending about 4 months of each year overseas, visiting all the Air Force Signals Intelligence Units and observing how they all ran as an enterprise. In addition to the typical military aide duties, keeping the general on schedule, ensuring he had the materials he needed for meetings, coordinating visitors, etc., General Koira tasked me with writing and editing much of his correspondence, which was a big responsibility for a very junior officer, and gave me a new insight into the big issues with which the Air Force Security Service and its leaders dealt. Then, after a few trips together, he asked me to prepare and deliver an update on headquarters issues to each unit we visited. The assignment was a catalyst for my career. I felt that I was doing something challenging, interesting, and worthwhile. And I also got to see the scope of the massive signals intelligence effort the United States was conducting. Because of the size of the Soviet Union and China, high-frequency Morse code was the primary way to effectively communicate across such vast distances. So the entire Eurasian landmass was ringed with SIGINT sites, stretching from Japan to Turkey to Britain. Each signals intelligence station employed hundreds of GIs, soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, copying dits and das around the clock, day in and day out. Nine stations employed FLIR-9 circular disposed antenna arrays, massive things we called elephant cages, to intercept transmissions and to direction find where each signal came from. If two stations picked up the same transmission, we could estimate where it came from by drawing lines on a map from each station and marking where in China or the Soviet Union the lines crossed. Putting the translated content of the communications together with the transmission location gave us very useful intelligence about our adversaries' capabilities and what was going on inside their borders. Before I traveled the world with General Koira, I never could have imagined just how massive, manpower-intensive, and costly the U.S. effort to collect and understand Soviet secrets really was. As the intelligence and combat missions in Southeast Asia increased, the Air Force brought new capabilities to bear. In March 1968, it first deployed the SR-71 Blackbird to Kadena Air Force Base in Okinawa, Japan. It was magnificent, a mind-boggling machine that could fly at the edge of space at unbelievable speeds and collect intelligence over huge areas, virtually impervious to all contemporary anti-aircraft systems. In the space of 20 minutes, it could fly over all of North Vietnam and image everything that was worth imaging and intercept all the signals worth collecting. About 5 days later, we'd get a readout of what it had collected. Of course, by then, much of the data it had gathered was already obsolete. In other words, great intelligence, just too late to be useful to the combat forces. Intelligence on the Soviets moved even more slowly. After Gary Powers's U-2 was shot down in May 1960, the United States stopped flights over Soviet airspace and thus lost coverage of Soviet capabilities, particularly on their strategic nuclear weapons. Fortunately, the launch of Sputnik on October 4, 1957, had opened another avenue for collection. Before Sputnik, there had been a huge debate about the legal repercussions of satellites crossing national borders. Just how far up did sovereign airspace extend? If we put something in orbit above adversarial nations, what precedent would that set? Sputnik overflew national borders all over the world, sending radio signals intended, literally, to let everyone know the Soviets didn't care about national borders when it came to spaceflight. In February 1959, the Air Force attempted the launch of its first overhead collection capability, Corona. The first launch vehicle never left the pad. In assessing America's early successes in space photo reconnaissance and just how much they changed the game against the Soviets, people tend to forget that in 1959 and 1960, our first 13 attempts at Corona failed. Those early space collection pioneers had to answer to Congress and the President, admit to setbacks, and convince them to be patient. I can attest those sorts of meetings aren't easy. Having given such briefings many times as Undersecretary of Defense and as Director of National Intelligence, I doubt today's Congress would have the patience to accept multiple failures in the interest of a breakthrough in technology. I suspect that its impatience today is manifested in the constant drumbeat for acquisition reform, as though improved bureaucratic processes for developing, building, and fielding new weapon systems, satellites, etc., would make technological progress easy and efficient. In 1961, the CIA and Air Force agreed to establish the National Reconnaissance Office, NRO, which joined CIA, NSA, and DIA as a fourth major national intelligence agency. NRO acquired and operated satellites to collect intelligence from orbit, starting with the Corona program. I first saw Corona imagery while working for General Koira in the late 1960s, and was amazed at the volume and precision of intelligence it gathered on Soviet strategic facilities. To transport these images, Corona had to launch film canisters back to Earth about every 6 weeks. The skilled crew of a specially configured C-130 transport plane would snag a parachute conveying a canister as it descended. The film would then be processed by the recce techs, the imagery analysts in the Air Force reconnaissance technical groups, as well as by the CIA's National Photographic Interpretation Center, NPIC. The result was an astoundingly complete picture of the way the world had been a few weeks before. Traveling the world, I found that the speed of intelligence was one of the great frustrations for our professionals deployed in the field. In August 1969, General Koira was assigned to Japan as the Vice Commander of the 5th Air Force. His deputy, Brigadier General Carl Stapleton, fleeted up to commander of the Air Force Security Service on August 1st, which was great for me, as General Stapleton also took a personal interest in my career. I mentioned to him that I had finished all the coursework for my master's degree and only had to complete my thesis. I decided to write about how an equal opportunity policy in off-base housing at Goodfellow Air Force Base, just 4 hours' drive from Kelly, had impacted both service members and the local community. The Defense Department had published a regulation requiring property owners who rented to any service members to agree to rent to all service members, regardless of race. If they refused to rent to minorities, they'd be placed on a list of owners from whom all service members were not allowed to rent. I'd dug into the literature on race relations in the United States in the late 1960s and found that while the military services were not exactly shining beacons of hope for racial harmony, Truman's order to desegregate the military in 1948 had at least forced people to work together, which led to a grudging respect for individual professional contributions, regardless of race. In theory, a regulation like the one regarding housing could extend some of that social change into the local community. General Stapleton, who had served as commander of Goodfellow, was intrigued. He set up interviews for me, both with base leaders and with city officials, and I discovered that not only was the new DOD policy good for minority service members, particularly black service members who could now find decent places to live, but economically it benefited the city and the property owners who participated. I concluded that the DOD regulation worked and had the intended impact of broadening housing opportunities for minorities. General Stapleton had copies of my thesis placed in the Security Service Library and the Air University Library at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. Stapleton also recognized that while my tour as his and General Koira's aide was a positive catalyst for my career, I needed to move on. I had mentioned on our travels together that I found the airborne signals collection mission intriguing. We'd visited detachments of EC-47 signals intelligence planes flying in South Vietnam and Thailand, doing essentially the same missions as the Flare 9 elephant cages, while airborne. The airmen in the back of the plane would intercept the transmission, note the direction it had come from, and then intercept another line of bearing a few minutes later. They'd map out where the lines of bearing intercepted, and then pass targeting data on where the enemy transmitter was for attack aircraft or troops on the ground. It wasn't as high-tech as the SR-71. But it was timely. I'd also seen that, unlike the units in Vietnam, the detachment in Thailand had been manned by airmen solely on 90-day temporary duty orders. As a result, they weren't a cohesive unit, and they needed help. I volunteered to go back to Southeast Asia for a second year-long tour as the first permanent commander of this detachment. Since this assignment would include flight time over hostile territory, I needed extensive training. I attended survival training at Fairchild Air Force Base near Spokane, Washington, in March 1970, which included a lot of being cold, wet, and hungry while hiking and camping in the woods. This culminated in being captured and detained in a simulated prisoner of war camp, where I was slapped around and thrown against walls, deprived of sleep, blasted with noise, and locked inside a small box that amplified my claustrophobia in a terrible way. Thankfully, this was in the days before survival, evasion, resistance, and escape training included waterboarding. We were told that while the United States followed the Geneva Conventions on the treatment of prisoners of war, the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong would use much worse torture techniques on captives than anything we had experienced in training. Decades later, after 9/11, I would remember the moral certitude with which our instructors in 1970 stressed that the United States would never use those techniques except to train our own troops. I next attended water survival training at Perrin Air Force Base in Texas, where we were taught how to free ourselves from parachute rigging to avoid drowning, and how to conserve energy and survive until we could be rescued. The training included 5 parasailing jumps, during which we were harnessed into a chute and towed behind a speedboat. Upon reaching the requisite height, we disconnected and executed a water landing. Those 5 jumps were fun. The final exercise, however, was not. We were tossed over the stern of the speedboat in a full harness in complete darkness. I remember tumbling through the water, disoriented about which way was up, struggling with the harness, swallowing water, struggling more, and being certain I was going to drown. But I survived, graduated, and went off to attend a week-long jungle survival course at Clark Air Base in the Philippines. I felt extremely well prepared for my assignment after enduring these courses, which I never wanted to take again. The final training I took before leaving the States was voluntary and entirely intellectual. EC-47s were weight-restricted and had no room for sightseeing visitors, so the only way I could fly on operational missions from Thailand was to perform an aircrew function. I wasn't a pilot, and since the only function I could qualify for was as an enlisted airborne analyst, I attended an analysis course for warrant and non-commissioned officers at the Army's Two Rock Ranch Station near Petaluma, California, which also qualified me as a fledgling subject matter expert on North Vietnamese Army communications practices. I arrived at Nakhon Phanom Royal Thai Air Force Base in June 1970. The state of my unit wasn't pretty. Our offices were a series of semi-trailers linked together with a plywood hallway that leaked whenever it rained, which was frequently. We had no latrines or running water, and we were the only flying unit with no air conditioning in our barracks, which was against Air Force regulations for flight crew rest. Our discipline was terrible. Our first sergeant informed me that we had the distinction of the highest venereal disease rate of any unit on base. I thought that was impressive, considering our guys were only there on 90-day temporary duty orders. They weren't wasting any time before getting infected on community outreach operations. I took command, but raising our living conditions, morale, and discipline felt like swimming upstream against stiff currents. About 6 weeks later, an old, seasoned Inspector General Colonel from the Security Service Regional Headquarters in Hawaii arrived. Normally no one is happy at the prospect of an IG inspection, but I realized that my unit needed help, so I showed him and his team every problem I'd identified and let them see anything else they wanted. Unsurprisingly, he judged our unit to be barely mission capable. About a week later, I got a call informing me that the base wing commander required my presence immediately. I raced to headquarters, already feeling awkward in my combat fatigues, only to find that standing with the base commander was 4-star General Joseph Nazaro, who was in charge of all U.S. Air Force units across the entire Indo-Asia-Pacific region. The general sat and gestured for me to sit next to him. "You're running an important mission here," he told me. "What support do you need?" Glancing at the wing commander, I told the 4-star that we lacked vehicles, air conditioning, and running water, but that my temporary duty crew members were making the best of the situation and were executing 5 flying missions daily. My attempt to put a positive face on the situation felt very hollow. He thanked and dismissed me, and the next day we were issued a couple of jeeps and trucks and were moved into a permanent barracks with air conditioning. Soon after, I started getting enlisted crew members on permanent change-of-station tours. Over the years, I've kept tabs on the members of that unit, and I am very proud that 13 of its enlisted airmen were eventually promoted to the highest Air Force enlisted grade of Chief Master Sergeant. One became the Command Non-Commissioned Officer for all of the Air Force Security Service, a command of about 20,000 people. Unlike the EC-47 units in South Vietnam that were collecting intelligence for tactical strikes or raids in Vietnam, my unit was flying over Laos, and in 1970, the secret war there did not involve conventional U.S. military forces. As an active participant in our missions, I'd taken my turns in the rotation of flight analysts, looking up call signs in a technical aid book, helping manually plot fixes in Laos, and then transmitting them to the ground. That, combined with the interest the four-star general took in our work, confirmed what I'd suspected from early on. We were actually working for the CIA station chief in Vientiane, Laos, who was providing our fixes for Laotian forces that the United States was secretly supporting. I flew my final mission on June 2, 1971, and just a few weeks before I left, the same old, crusty Inspector General Colonel inspected my unit, and this time we passed with flying colors. I'm keeping this pun in defiance of all my editors. I left Thailand on June 3rd with a sense of professional satisfaction and personal accomplishment that I seldom experienced during the rest of my military career. I felt I had really done something significant, that I had molded that unit into a true capability for the Air Force and U.S. intelligence. I was extremely proud of my troops and the unit I left behind when I flew home to my family. After Thailand, General Stapleton decided I should see the bigger picture of the world of signals intelligence beyond what the Air Force was doing, and so he planted me at NSA as the military assistant to the director, replacing a senior Air Force lieutenant colonel as a rather junior captain. In my final performance review, Stapleton wrote, "I'm more confident in Captain Clapper's ability to be a general than I am in any of my colonels." That felt a bit over the top, even at the time, and I doubt that he mentioned that assessment to any of those colonels. When Sue and I arrived at our old stomping grounds of Fort Meade, the NSA director was Vice Admiral Noel Giler. He was a handsome, swashbuckling Navy fighter pilot, a certified ace for having downed 5 enemy planes during World War II. He was the first naval aviator to be awarded 3 Navy Crosses, the Combat Valor Award second only to the Medal of Honor. Giler was smart, capable, arrogant, and overbearing. He ruled by fear and intimidation, suffered no fools, and fired people on the spot if they didn't measure up. That said, his leadership approach was effective. People worked feverishly for long hours to get the job done on schedule, and NSA headquarters led the global signals intelligence effort for the nation. I practically lived at my desk, just outside Giler's office, returning home only to sleep. When our son Andy was born, Sue remarked that the only real difference in the circumstances of his birth from Jennifer's was that I'd found out about it more quickly. In August 1972, Giler was promoted to full admiral and left for Hawaii to serve as the 4-star commander-in-chief, U.S. Pacific Command, and was replaced by Lieutenant General Sam Phillips. While Giler was famous for his combat prowess and leadership, Phillips was known for managing large, complex technical projects. He'd been the Apollo program director from 1963 to 1969, the driving force behind putting a man on the moon. Shortly after Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took humankind's first stroll on a celestial body, Phillips announced he was returning to his Air Force career. After command of the Space and Missile Systems Organization in Los Angeles, he came to NSA. General Phillips was quiet, courteous, serious, and brilliant. An introvert and a gentleman, he seemed the antithesis of Admiral Giler. From observing him, I learned that while fear and intimidation can drive people to do their jobs well, they'll only do what they are told. Under Phillips's leadership, people gave their best, as it pained them to let him down, knowing he had their backs. His staff brought him bad news without fear and let him know when things were going wrong, soon enough for him to act. There was plenty of bad news in those first few years of the 1970s. Anti-war fever had taken hold, and demonstrations were taking place all around the country. Race relations in America were at a low point, marked by riots and burning cities. The military, reflecting society at large, had its own race relations issues, as well as problems with discipline, particularly among the draftees. In January 1973, the United States signed the Paris Peace Accords, in which we agreed to recognize the independence, sovereignty, unity, and territorial integrity of Vietnam. By March, we'd pulled all our forces out of the country. Despite the endgame of the war, and despite the reported thaw in U.S.-Soviet relations in the 1970s, détente, as it was called, our all-consuming target at NSA continued to be the Soviets. NSA was deeply involved with enhancing collection, particularly on their nuclear weapons programs, and we made a strong push to develop the technologies necessary to put signals intelligence systems into space. While military aide to General Phillips in 1973, I was promoted to major, a year below the zone, before the time when I was supposed to be considered for promotion. I would go on to be promoted 3 years below the zone to lieutenant colonel, after just 14 months as a major, and an additional year early to colonel, 5 years before I should have made colonel in the normal progression. That's not to say I didn't make mistakes. I made a big career error in 1973 by following General Phillips as he picked up his fourth star and took command of the Air Force Systems Command, the organization tasked with research, development, and acquisition of new weapons systems. I admired his leadership to the point that I wanted to go with him, regardless of what work I'd be doing. At Systems Command, I faced a frustrating situation, since a full colonel was already installed to do what I'd done for General Phillips at NSA. The position I now occupied had been held by the pilot tasked with flying the general around. I wasn't a pilot, and effectively having nothing to do was not career-enhancing. I realized my mistake and asked General Phillips to help. He set up several interviews, and I ended up in the Intelligence Office of Systems Command, in the Foreign Material Acquisition Program. This was a positive turn of events that got me involved in acquiring adversary military equipment, purchasing whole systems or collecting pieces left on battlefields to assemble into complete systems. This was a major Cold War enterprise and profoundly interesting, but it was far removed from the operational duties I most enjoyed. After 5 months at the Armed Forces Staff College in Norfolk, Virginia, I was assigned to U.S. Pacific Command, back on Admiral Guiler's staff, but sufficiently down the food chain that I wasn't in his direct line of sight again. When I arrived at Camp Smith, Hawaii, I was appointed to work shifts as a watch officer, giving me flashbacks to my time at Tansonut Air Base a decade earlier. I appealed to Brigadier General Doyle Larson, who was the senior intelligence officer, the J-2 in military parlance, and whom I knew from the Air Force Security Service, and told him I'd already served as a watch officer in a war zone. He agreed that the assignment wasn't career progressive and moved me into the intelligence collection branch as an action officer. Then when I was promoted early to lieutenant colonel, Larson made me the signals intelligence branch chief. As a mentor, he influenced my next three assignments. At Pacific Command, we focused on the Soviet Far East and China, and of course, North Korea. Open combat between the United States and North Korea had stopped with the 1953 armistice, but the war technically never ended, and soldiers from North Korea still stare across a 4-kilometer-wide demilitarized zone, a no-man's land between North and South Korea, at South Korean and U.S. soldiers, who to this day warily stare back. On August 18, 1976, a South Korean working party went out to trim a massive poplar tree that blocked the view across the DMZ. North Korean troops soon appeared and ordered them to stop. In the ensuing confrontation, the two U.S. Army officers in charge of the working party were beaten to death with axes. The Pacific Command turned its attention to the tense situation and any intercepts of North Korean communications on the incident. 3 days later, a muscular contingent of U.S. Army and South Korean Special Forces returned to the scene, backed up by attack helicopters, fighter aircraft, and even B-52 bombers, which the North Koreans knew could carry nuclear weapons. A North Korean convoy arrived and set up machine gun positions, but didn't open fire. During an hour-long standoff, U.S. Army engineers cut the tree down. The mission was aptly named Operation Paul Bunyan. Tensions between North and South escalated, and the U.S. Air Force B-52s continued to fly patrols parallel to the DMZ. The North Koreans, in turn, put their air defense systems on high alert, flew MiG fighters on frequent patrols, and dispatched their submarines out to sea. We intercepted communications indicating that Kim Il-sung might order an invasion into South Korea. I stayed in the office for about 3 days without going home, communicating via teletype with an army major who was my counterpart in South Korea. The sense of an imminent war was palpable through the crisis, and it took several weeks for the situation to stabilize enough for us to fall back into a regular rhythm. That was precisely the kind of intelligence work I'd joined the military to do. But in the summer of 1978, the Air Force decided it was once again time to invest in my education. Sue, Jenny, Andy, and I returned to the mainland so I could attend the prestigious National War College in Washington. The Air Force Personnel Office told me to plan on a follow-on assignment to the Pentagon, so we bought a townhouse in the Lake Braddock community of Burke, not far from where I'd lived with my parents when my dad was assigned to Arlington Hall. Unfortunately, I hadn't learned from my dad's experience, because after I completed my studies, the Air Force, thanks to the intervention of Doyle Larson, instead assigned me to NSA. I began making the long commute around D.C. to Fort Meade in Maryland, just like Dad had. The only real difference was, for good or ill, I got to use the Capitol Beltway, the proposed circumferential highway of the 1950s, for my commute. In 1979, the Army, Navy, and Air Force all had cryptologic commands to conduct both signals intelligence and communications security missions, breaking and making code. The Army and Navy maintained their headquarters in Washington, whereas the Air Force Security Service was deliberately located elsewhere at Kelly Air Force Base in San Antonio, where I'd spent so much of my early career. The Air Force needed a senior resident officer at NSA to represent its positions, and in June 1979, I took on that role. Then, in February 1980, when NSA Director Vice Admiral Bobby Inman officiated at my promotion to colonel, I took charge of all the Air Force personnel stationed at NSA, several thousand people, as the first Air Force wing commander at Fort Meade. My most demanding work mostly consisted of being the intermediary between Admiral Inman and Major General Larson, who, subsequent to being PACOM's senior intelligence officer, had become commander of the Air Force Security Service and received his second star. Larson incorporated other parts of Air Force intelligence into the agency and transformed it into the Electronic Security Command to make it more operationally relevant. It was no secret that Larson saw his natural career progression as becoming the next NSA director, a point of sensitivity with Admiral Inman, who was in Larson's way. I had to spend a good bit of my time and energy during the next year and a half as a diplomat, smoothing flag and general officer feathers whenever either was ruffled. I consider Bobby Inman an icon and a legend. With the Navy, at NSA, and at CIA, where he became deputy director in 1981. As of this writing, he still has a full-time teaching position at the University of Texas. People everywhere have stories about his uncanny mastering of the details of signals intelligence operations, or astutely handling demanding members of Congress. Many accounts involve the joint operations policies he promoted in 1981, when, for just a few months, he was simultaneously NSA director and CIA deputy director. To me, none of the bold actions Inman is famous for hold a candle to something I saw him very quietly do to protect one NSA employee. In 1979, shortly after I started making the daily commute to Fort Meade, Inman learned that a gifted senior civilian crypto-mathematician was gay. He wasn't living openly, but enough people knew that Inman would have to confront the situation. For uniformed service members, like the two airmen I'd had to deal with in 1964, being outed meant immediate, general, or dishonorable discharge. But because civilians weren't bound by the Uniform Code of Military Justice, an extra step was required to dismiss them. Guidance for processing security clearances said that anyone who was homosexual was vulnerable to blackmail by foreign intelligence services and therefore was not suitable for holding a clearance. If anyone at a command was discovered to be gay, commanders were required to revoke their clearance, effectively ending their employment and their career. By the time this case reached Inman, the NSA security office had already administratively removed the employee's clearance and was in the throes of firing him. Inman halted the process and asked the employee to come to his office. Inman told the man that he could not retain his clearance as long as he was vulnerable to blackmail. However, Inman reasoned that if he acknowledged his sexual orientation to his co-workers, family, and friends, he could no longer be blackmailed, and Inman could restore his clearance. The employee agreed and returned to his job. That decision was still tragic on a personal level, since it compelled someone to come out publicly on the government's terms and timetable. Still, it was a compassionate and courageous gesture, and an absolute revelation to me. 10 years later, when I was a major general serving as the chief of Air Force Intelligence in the Pentagon in 1989, I was confronted with a similar situation regarding a civilian employee who'd been outed. As the senior intelligence officer for the entire United States Air Force, I had significant authority that I certainly didn't possess in 1964, and so I followed Admiral Inman's example and restored the clearance of my employee, Mark Roth. Mark went on to serve our nation with great distinction, achieving the grade of senior executive. He is retired now, but still serving his country. My decision set a precedent in the Air Force, and I took some flack from a few of my general officer colleagues, but it was the right thing to do, for Mark, for the Air Force, and for our country. And although I didn't admit it to myself at the time, perhaps I was also trying to atone for my part in what had happened to those two Russian linguist airmen 25 years earlier. Chapter 2. Command and Controversy. While mentoring from senior officers meant so much to my early career, when I arrived at the Pentagon in 1981, I met a peer who would have a major impact on me and become a lifelong friend in the process. Rich O'Lear had been commissioned from the Air Force Academy the same year I was commissioned from ROTC, and he was also a fast burner, having been promoted to colonel 4 years ahead of the typical schedule. When we were both assigned to work for the Air Force Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, the senior intelligence officer at Air Force Headquarters, Major General Jim Fouts, Rich was initially slotted as my deputy. We were both type A competitive people, and I suspect those who knew us thought the competitive chemistry would put us in conflict. That didn't happen. Rich had a very different background from mine. While I'd been focused on signals intelligence, he'd spent more time in the realm of strategic air command in all-source analysis, fitting signal intercepts, imagery, and human intelligence together to discover and present the big picture of our adversary's capabilities and intentions. But we shared a passion for getting the mission done, and we gelled from the start. General Fouts was an exacting and commanding boss with high expectations and a sharp temper when those expectations weren't met. Rich taught me a lot about the tricks of the staff work trade he'd learned at SAC, how to prepare and deliver briefings, and particularly, how to treat people. In many ways, his professionalism reminded me of my dad's. I was, additionally, thankful that work was closer to home. Not having to move for another 3 years allowed Jennifer to spend her entire high school career at the same school, and Sue and I both appreciated giving her an opportunity neither of us had had. Establishing roots in our neighborhood somehow led to my becoming elected president of our homeowners association, something I would never want to do again. It was akin to being unpaid mayor for 1,300 families, managing a 17-acre lake, tennis courts, a pool, and full-time office and maintenance staffs. I discovered that the only people who attended association meetings were those with fervent complaints, and I found it striking just how emotionally attached townhouse owners could become to specific parking places and how much hate and discontent renters could cause owners. While I was president, our community became one of the first in Fairfax County to establish a neighborhood watch program. To get better acquainted with how the county police force worked, I asked to go on ride-alongs. By accompanying officers on patrol, I saw how they operated and how they had absolutely no idea what they would confront when they made a traffic stop or responded to a domestic dispute. My experience with the Fairfax County Police Department would prove helpful years later when I was DNI. After 9/11, the intelligence community worked to share information from classified sources with state and local law enforcement officers who did not hold security clearances. The people who might actually encounter terrorists or deal with the immediate aftermath of an attack. When, as DNI, I met with the International Association of Chiefs of Police, those ride-alongs served as a shared frame of reference from which we could talk about much bigger issues involving the entire country. Since Rich and I didn't live far apart, we carpooled to the Pentagon, planning our strategy for the day, and, after parking, worked as a fire team to watch for the huge rats that then lurked in the Pentagon's south parking lot. There were two major subordinate staff offices under General Fouts, one focused on programs and budgets, and the other on substantive intelligence matters, actual analysis of adversary capabilities and activities. We were assigned to the first, which made me glad for the mistake I had made in following General Phillips to Air Force Systems Command. That experience constituted my only familiarity with how the Air Force builds and acquires intelligence systems, providing me with just enough understanding to be absolutely blown away when I first learned about the F-117 Nighthawk and its unconventional design and stealth technology. Within a few months, Rich became the head of the Analytical Substance Directorate, at which point we reported to General Fouts as peers. One of our chief tasks each day was to prepare him to brief the Air Force Chief of Staff at senior staff meetings, including preparing his slides with updates on intelligence systems and the current intelligence picture. Pentagon staff officers today often lament the rise of PowerPoint. They only complain because they're too young to remember making ViewGraph slides and printing them on cellulose acetate transparency sheets to display with an overhead projector. Rich and I had no idea how quickly one of our presentations would gain national prominence. On September 1, 1983, a Soviet Su-15 interceptor fighter jet shot down Korean Airlines Flight 007 over the Sea of Japan. The Boeing 747 had taken off from Anchorage, Alaska, with 269 people aboard, including Representative Larry McDonald, en route to Seoul. Its autopilot had been set in the wrong mode, and the plane drifted northwest of its intended course. As it approached Soviet prohibited airspace over Kamchatka Peninsula in the dark of night, Soviet air defenses scrambled three MiG-23 fighters, which failed to intercept the airliner. KAL-007 crossed the peninsula back into international airspace over the Sea of Japan as a flight of Su-15s were launched. While the fighters approached, the KAL-007 pilot asked Tokyo Air Traffic Control Center for permission to climb to conserve fuel. Tokyo Center, which didn't have radar contact with KAL-007 and was unaware of the Soviet jets, approved the request. As the 747 climbed, it lost airspeed, and the interceptor jets flew past it. They interpreted the climb as an evasive maneuver, turned, regained visual contact, and fired two air-to-air missiles, destroying the civilian airliner and killing everyone aboard. Immediately, and in typical character, the Soviets denied any involvement, asserting the airliner had crashed on its own, and began fabricating evidence to support their claim. In the Pentagon, General Fouts asked Rich and me if the Air Force had any reconnaissance aircraft in the area, and whether any intelligence systems had collected data that would cast light on the matter. We pulsed all the Air Force collection stations, and initially had nothing to report. We then learned that the intercept site at the northernmost tip of Hokkaido, Japan, had been conducting a test during the day and had left its receivers and recorders tuned to the Soviet air-to-ground frequency that night. The system happened to intercept the entire exchange of Soviet air-to-ground communications, although the linguists there hadn't realized immediately the significance of what they had on tape. Rich and I reconstructed the path of the airliner and plotted it on a map. We correlated the times of the Soviet radio transmissions on the transcript with the location of the airliner. Using view graphs, we put together a slide deck that showed the failed intercept by the MiG-23s when the airliner entered Soviet airspace and how KAL-007 had already entered international airspace, not just when it was shot down, but as the Soviet general on the ground transmitted, "How long does it take him to get into attack position? He is already getting out into neutral waters. Engage afterburner immediately. Bring in the MiG-23 as well. While you're wasting time, it will fly right out." Most damning, the Soviet general subsequently ordered the Su-15 pilots to shoot the target down immediately, without visually confirming its identity. General Fouts presented the Air Force Chief of Staff our findings, which were then sent that day to the Secretary of Defense and to the National Security Council in the White House. The Soviets continued their denials until the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations played the recorded voice transmissions for the Security Council on September 5th. On September 7th, President Reagan declassified and published the transcript, a textbook example of a president appropriately asserting his prerogative to declassify intelligence information. The Soviets finally admitted their involvement, but claimed they'd confused the airliner with a U.S. military reconnaissance plane flying at the same time. The Air Force Chief of Staff asked Fouts if we'd run any missions that day. Fouts asked me to check, and I was told we hadn't. Information, it turned out, that wasn't exactly correct. We had, in fact, flown an RC-135, the specific reconnaissance aircraft the Soviets said they thought KAL-007 was, that same day, but during daylight hours, long before KAL-007 was shot down. The reconnaissance flight was unscheduled and a reaction to indications that the Soviets were going to conduct an intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, test launch. The launch didn't take place, but the RC-135 had been in position near Soviet airspace, ready to collect information if it had. Fouts learned about the RC-135 flight very early Sunday morning and called me at home, yelling before I could even say hello. For the next 10 minutes, I lay in bed at the position of attention as he informed me in very specific terms about the error of my ways. That was one of the many, many times I thought my career was dead, but I never heard another word about the incident. Almost 2 months later, on October 25th, U.S. Army Rangers Airborne, Marines, and Special Forces invaded the Caribbean island of Grenada to liberate it from the leftist organization that had taken control in a 1979 coup. The invasion itself was widely criticized around the world as unnecessary overkill, and even in the United States, opinion was mixed. The operation itself was an absolutely overwhelming, if chaotic, show of force. Troops on the ground didn't have current charts from the Defense Mapping Agency, and were forced to navigate the island with old maps from the Esso oil conglomerate. Communications weren't established early. Famously, troops had to use payphones to coordinate movements. Military intelligence was blamed, but the actual problem was that the invasion planners didn't bother to inform us of their plans. We were completely out of the loop and didn't catch up until the action was almost over, only a few days later. This episode brought to mind the old Air Force saw, "If you want me around when the plane crashes, have me around when the plane takes off." The coordination problem in Grenada wasn't limited to intelligence. Each military service had made its own operational plans without fully coordinating with the others, and the result was less than optimal. We were very fortunate to confront this issue during the invasion of Grenada, which put up virtually no resistance, as it influenced the reorganization of the Department of Defense with the 1986 Goldwater-Nichols Act. Under this landmark law, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, every branch of the military, were to organize, train, and equip the troops who would do the fighting. The combatant commanders, each with control of all the troops and equipment within their geographic area of responsibility, were tasked with planning and executing operations. In 1983, I had no idea that the nuances of Goldwater-Nichols would become important to me just a few years later. That December, General Fouts called me into his office and said he'd negotiated my next assignment, commander of the Air Force Technical Application Center at Patrick Air Force Base, not far from Cocoa Beach, Florida. Since the 1950s, AFTAC had always been commanded by an Air Force pilot, never by an intelligence officer. So I honestly wasn't sure whether he was rewarding or banishing me. Sue and I agreed that the AFTAC posting would be a pretty good twilight tour for us, after which we could retire and settle down. We'd also be able to keep Andy in the same high school for 4 years in Florida, so we bought a nice house on a corner lot in Satellite Beach, not far from the ocean. AFTAC had the unique and important task of monitoring compliance with the 1963 Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which banned all nuclear tests except those conducted underground, and it lived by the wonderfully apt informal motto, "In God we trust, all others we monitor." At the time, it had about 3,000 people deployed all over the world, monitoring seismic signatures, ocean acoustic signatures, and overhead satellites for anything resembling a nuclear detonation. It would then try to collect samples from the air to see if the underground tests had vented particles. The AFTAC laboratory at McClellan Air Force Base in California would then torture the molecules for intelligence about the actual detonation. One of its major challenges was to distinguish nuclear tests from earthquakes, and to try to compute the location, size, and type of detonation from this arcane data. It operated a series of small detachments intentionally located in remote, seismically quiet places all over the world. AFTAC had the global reach of a major command, but was small enough to be commanded by a colonel. It had a staff of wonderfully talented, dedicated people, Air Force active duty officers and enlisted technicians, and a small cadre of civilian experts, some of whom had been involved in the Manhattan Project to build the first atomic bomb. For the most part, it existed and did its work without any meddling from Washington. I arrived and took command in June 1984. During my brief tenure as commander, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, France, China, and, of course, the United States were all actively conducting underground tests, but we didn't observe any treaty violations. AFTAC would be the last of three Air Force organizations I would have the privilege and honor of commanding. Unique to the military, command is a special responsibility, not only for the conduct of the unit's mission, but also for the well-being of its people and their families. A heavy responsibility, but so rewarding. That December, the Air Force published the names of those nominated for promotion to Brigadier General, and I was on the list. I was shocked. My parents and family were very proud, and Sue and Andy got ready to move again. Fortuitously, Rich O'Lear succeeded me as commander of AFTAC, and he and his family rented our house. I anticipated returning to the Pentagon.